Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. Well, as we're enjoying fall, which is upon us, although it seems like summer some days, but you can see the leaves starting to turn a little bit and the colors ready to come out. And maybe by virtue of the fact that we have all of this water, we'll see those colors a little longer. But a little essay about fall, an ode and a plea to autumn. Fall, the autumnal season. The words themselves have a rich sound, bringing to mind chestnut brown tweed jackets and golden brown apple pies. Although the temperature has threatened to reach 90 this week, we haven't given up hope of curling up in front of a blazing fire with a cup of hot cider and a good book. Maybe one of these weekends we'll even need a jacket at the high school football game. But until the weather aligns itself with the calendar, we'll keep dreaming about our favorite ways to enjoy this glorious season. Fall is all things apple. Slightly chunky homemade applesauce, dark brown apple butter loaded with flavor, diced Granny Smith apples cooked in butter and brown sugar, moist applesauce raisin cake covered with brown sugar frosting, steaming apple cider with a touch of cinnamon and cloves. What would fall be like without warm apple crisp, sweet and crunchy yet tart and tangy? Of course, the ultimate all-American apple dish, apple pie baked in a flaky, buttery crust sprinkled with white table sugar, is perfect for any season. And no fall is complete without a trip to an apple orchard and apple picking, eating, bobbing, and baking that follow. A caramel apple on a crisp fall evening will melt away time, at least for a little while. In fall, the smell of outdoor cooking is different than it is in summer. The breeze carries woodsy, smoky scents, wrapping people in comfort like an old flannel shirt. The air smells sharp, tangy, and reminiscent of woods, damp leaves, and the promise of colder weather to come. The smell isn't salty as it is in winter, but full of pleasant, embracing odors, cinnamon, ripe fruit, and rain-soaked ground. Since fall is a perfect time for keeping the windows open, the scents fill houses, enticing people outdoors, and whether the cookout smell is coming from a campground or a backyard, it always encapsulates the feel of sitting around an open fire in the middle of the woods, sipping cider from a mug filled with a sense of peacefulness and also liveliness. Strange in a season when life is beginning to wind down. As the temperature drops, the indoor offers new allurements. Building the first fire of the season or stocking the workroom with all the supplies needed to finish a favorite project will help while away rainy fall afternoons. Scented candles, fabric leaves, homemade scarecrows, gourds, and pumpkins make the home cozy and inviting. Fall has no patience for the short and skimpy, so tank tops, capri pants, and flip-flops, be gone. Now is the time of the boot, ankle boots, knee-high boots, over-the-knee boots, suede boots, leather boots, furry boots, candy apple red boots. This is also the time of the jacket. From sturdy wool military-inspired pieces to long sweater coats. Like fashion, football, the most famous of fall pastimes, pays no heed to weather. Whether at the high school, college, or professional level, the one-game-a-week rhythm builds to a powerful crescendo right before kickoff. Supporters wear paint and diehards refuse to wear shirts as temperatures plummet. The bone-jarring tackles are a dramatic departure from the restrained atmosphere of baseball and golf. A touchdown is celebrated like a lottery jackpot. and victories mean fans can hold their heads high. Well, for at least another week. Yes, fall has much to offer, and summer is but a fond memory. An ode and a plea to autumn. What a great essay. Maybe a little music. Certainly one of the great songs from Cinema Paradiso, The Suite. And we'll be back on The Kevin Moore Show. Marconi's Cinema Paradiso, played by Dave Kazin. We're back on The Kevin Moore Show. On the heels of the highest grossing season in its history, the Joffrey Ballet opens 2018-2019 with a much-anticipated return of Christopher Wheeldon's Swan Lake, which became an audience favorite when it premiered in Chicago in 2014. Dance to Peter Ilya Tchaikovsky's classic score and perform live by the Chicago Philharmonic. Swan Lake is presented at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, 50 East Congress Parkway, in 10 performances only, October 17th through the 28th. A ballet in four acts, Wheeldon's modern retelling transports one of ballet's most famous works to the studios of the Paris Opera during the 19th century. The same era, Tchaikovsky composed Swan Lake in Moscow, and when a young impressionist named Edgar Degas was on the rise in Paris. The story begins as the dancers of the world's most famed ballet company prepare for opening night. Inspired by the paintings of Degas, with this opulent production follows Siegfried, a leading dancer who falls in love with his beautiful partner, Odette. When a wicked arts patron, von Rothbard, threatens to spoil their love, Siegfried is thrust into a world of mystery and wonder as the line between reality and fantasy suddenly blurs together in unexpected ways. Christopher is one of the most influential choreographers of our generation, said Ashley Weider, the Mary B. Galvin Artistic Director of the Joffrey. Performing his full-length ballets with regularity is a privilege, especially one as exquisite as Swan Lake. This is one of the most popular productions we've ever mounted, and we are thrilled to bring it back after 5 years for another run in Chicago. And online with us right now is the award-winning star of stage, screen, and television, world-renowned dancer, having performed with the legendary Rudolf Nureyev and Margot Fonteyn, teacher, mentor, member of the Royal Ballet, former ballet master of the San Francisco Ballet, visionary in the world of dance, and the artistic director of the world-famous Joffrey Ballet, now presenting Christopher Wheeldon's reimagining of Tchaikovsky's classic Swan Lake at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, Michigan to Congress, October 17th through the 28th. We welcome my good pal, Mr. Ashley Weider. Ashley, welcome back to the Kevin Moore Show.
Thank you, Kevin. It's great to be back on the show, and great to talk to you always.
Always a pleasure, my friend, and it's been a while. I hope you had a good summer.
We had a very, very busy summer, but it was good. We did quite a bit of traveling. Actually, the company performed in Paris and had a very successful run there. So I think that Chicago can be proud that we represented them in Paris.
And you know that Chicago is very proud, as is the world, to enjoy the Joffrey throughout the world. Paris, that must have been a lot of fun. How much time did you spend in Paris?
We were there for a week, and we performed four performances, and it was really fantastic. So we're hoping for another invitation.
Well, I'm sure you'll get one, and certainly other people will be wanting to have you come out and see them, too. You know, one of my favorite ballets, Swan Lake, of course, the triad of Tchaikovsky's great works, Sleeping Beauty, Swan Lake, and we're looking forward to the Nutcracker coming up in a couple months. But now this is a different reimagining with Christopher Wheeldon. We enjoyed this a few years ago and are doing so now again.
And I think, you know, Kevin, I think that coming back to Christopher's Swan Lake, you know, it's been really good for the company to be able to dig even deeper into his idea of this production representing the paintings of Degas and also of Toulouse-Lautrec. And I think that the idea of style, bringing those paintings to life, and yet we're also telling a narrative story. So we've been rehearsing a lot, and I have to say, I think that the company, it looks really good. I think it's going to be better than it was last time. I think definitely for the principal dancers that are taking the leads, to come back to the work and really dive in again and digest it, has been fantastic.
And for the people who haven't seen it the first time, of course you mentioned the great French Impressionist Degas and Toulouse-Lautrec. We see their paintings superimposed on the stage, and then we take that and see the dancers kind of replicate what they're seeing in the pictures.
Right. So, you know, I think one of the things is that Degas was probably the most prolific painter of ballet, right, and especially the behind the scenes at the Paris Opera. And in those paintings, there are various characters. There is the ballet master, but there are also these abons, these wealthy gentlemen who supported the companies, paid for the productions, and in return had access to the backstage and to the ballerinas. And of course that would be a no-no today. Mm-hmm. But in telling the stories and trying to keep Degas' work relative to the production, we see these characters. And what Christopher did with this kind of this Arbonne, this evil wealthy man, is he made him von Rothbart, who has control over all the swans.
Okay.
So he's kind of brought the characters to many dimensions of the story.
So we see the way Christopher presents this from the original kind of pastoral idea that the Tchaikovsky had, more contemporizing, and even though it's in the 19th century, contemporizing it to how this relates to the artistry of Degas and Toulouse-Lautrec.
Right. And because it's set in a ballet studio at the Paris Opera, there are huge French doors. And so where his imagination takes over from the reality of a rehearsal, all the doors open, and therefore we're allowing the room to be filled with ideas. And so the story, especially in the second act, all the swans arrive through the doors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, Chris's idea that this young boy who's been given the lead role is so consumed with the story that is it his imagination that we're watching, or is it for real? And what he's done, I think, beautifully, is he's really honored the original choreography for the lake scenes, which is beautiful. And then he added more of his own choreography in Act 1, which is in the studio, and then in Act 3 for the big pas de deux with Odile and the prince.
And that makes sense, because one of the most memorable parts of the classic ballet Swan Lake is the lake scene with all the swans, and as delicate as they are, you almost feel with their arms fluttering that you're looking at a swan.
Absolutely. And we, you know, when we're rehearsing them, it's, you know, to have so many people breathe as one breath throughout. I have to say that, you know, I'm immensely proud of the company and the work they put into everything they do. But when you get to, you know, a corps de ballet of ladies, and, you know, last year they were triumphant in Giselle. And I think that they realized that, you know, people really appreciate that hard work and that refinement of being a fantastic unit.
And I think that's why how you see the swans all dancing together, the idyllic nature of dance, of the dance in Swan Lake is very clear. The relationship between Siegfried, who's this young man in Christopher Wheeldon's ballet, and Odette, is one of complete sweetness and absolute trust, uncompromising, unconditional. They love each other, and this is what his focus is. But now we are asking ourselves, as is Siegfried, is this really happening?
Right.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
And, you know, the score is magnificent.
Always Tchaikovsky's work is, to me, just second to none. And you know, whether it's Sleeping Beauty or The Nutcracker or, of course, Swan Lake, it's you want to listen to this music, Ashley, even without seeing the ballet. You just like to put it on in your car and listen to it.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting, Kevin, that when it premiered in Russia, Swan Lake was not a success.
Really?
And I think that Tchaikovsky, apparently, according to a wonderful book on him, was very, very depressed about the fact that it wasn't successful. And it took him 10 years to then write The Sleeping Beauty.
Sleeping Beauty was his second ballet?
Yeah.
And then The Nutcracker.
Yeah, and I think that what's amazing is that they are like the three greatest works of Tchaikovsky for the ballet.
Sure.
And so, obviously, we're thrilled that it had a turnaround and it's become, you know, an all-time classic. I mean, Swan Lake and The Nutcracker, I think, for anybody, they are probably two works to access the world of ballet.
And yes, exactly. If you were going to introduce young people to the ballet, I would have to say that The Nutcracker, of course, or Swan Lake, or maybe even Giselle, because it's a beautiful love story, too. That's what you would introduce them to.
I think so. I mean, there is so much technical, athletic dancing, and yet there's this beautiful story, and I think it's very engaging, and I think that what Christopher has done so well with all of his productions is that he wants it to relate to children, to women, to men, to grandparents. You know, he doesn't believe that work belongs to a very certain kind of group of people. So I think that, you know, people can access his work very easily.
And I think that's what's very important, so very important, Ashley, is that, you know, we have to develop, and I think we've talked about this before, the next generation of ballet goers, theater goers, young people who see entertainment on the stage. And that's from us as parents or grandparents. I sure enjoy bringing my young ones to see the Nutcracker or, you know, the Christmas Carol and introducing them, because that's the next audience that we're going to be able to cultivate.
Absolutely. And I think that people need to, I think they just need, like, the theater is for everybody. And I think sometimes people think, well, you know, it's not for me, I can't afford it. But I just encourage people to just come, and, you know, you can get a ticket very inexpensively. We have many different ways to buy a ticket at different levels. But to walk into a theater and be totally swept away for an hour and a half or 2 hours is very good for our soul.
And I contend that's so true, because when you go to the theater, whether it's the ballet or the symphony or whatever theater is being presented, rather than sitting in front of a television set, very frankly, you feel better about yourself than you did when you went in, or you've learned something differently. And I think that it's our responsibility. You know, you say people feel a little uncomfortable. They feel uncomfortable because I think they're unprepared. If people would be prepared, read the story about the Swan Lake. Read the story about the Nutcracker. Be prepared as to what the story is about, so you're not – or the opera, because you're not going to understand the language necessarily that's being sung in the opera. But if you know the story – then right. You can come and enjoy the art of what's going on the stage, and you're not struggling with, well, what's going on. You already know what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that's a very good. I mean, you know, when I went to see Hamilton, I tried to get very familiar with the story. I listened to it because of the nature of how it's written. And so it was an amazing experience to go and see it. And I felt like I was prepared.
And I think that's a good point. In fact, I had that conversation with some friends last week. It's like going to Shakespeare. We don't speak in Elizabethan English. We don't necessarily speak in hip-hop, at least people I hang around with don't. So you have to acclimate yourself to the vernacular, what's on the stage, in Hamilton being an example. And once you get the cadence, what's going on, now you're enjoying what's on the stage and what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, very interesting. Very interesting. And, of course, coming off the highest grossing season in your history, congratulations. That's great.
Thank you.
Celebrating your 10th anniversary. That's a great way to spend your 10th anniversary.
It was. I just was, you know, Kevin, I think that, you know, we're a team at the Joffrey, and I think that it's important that everyone feels included. I'm so proud of the entire organization for making the season so incredibly successful. And, of course, you know, the company who get up night after night and deliver excellence is really, you cannot ask for more.
And I've noticed that you have a whole new boatload of new dancers that they're with the Joffrey now.
Yes, we had an amazing gift from Joseph and Margaret Konashok to increase the number of dancers in the company. And we've also been able to increase their work weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, just for your listeners, that we do lots of surveys about where companies are and how companies are doing. And when they surveyed all the major companies in America, ballet companies, they realized that the Joffrey Ballet and another major company in New York really take on twice the workload of
really?
Other companies.
Wow.
So it was a very interesting data for us to look at. So having more dancers in the company has really allowed us to give, first of all, more opportunity, but also give people the rest that they need. Because if you're dancing the role of Odette O'Deal in Swan Lake, the amount of push that you deliver in 2.5 hours on your body is quite incredible.
Interesting.
So you need downtime.
Is there any value to have a season that runs longer or for an entire year without a break? I know you don't have a break because you go away for the summer and certainly perform, but is there any value to that?
I think that, you know, we were actually talking about this the other day, that we finish at the very beginning of May, and then people in Chicago don't see the company again until the middle of October.
Right.
And I think that there is a demand if we did a program in May, June. So, and then we could space out our year a little bit more, and I think that that also would be a good thing.
Well, you know how I feel about the classical ballet. I enjoy last year enjoying Giselle was just wonderful, and Swan Lake is a heck of a way to kick off this season too, and that's something to look forward to. But and I know that this season we're also going to have Anna Karenina,
which we have been working on side by side with Swan Lake. So mm-hmm. Yuri Pozhikov, who is creating Anna Karenina, has been here. It's a commissioned score by a brilliant young Russian composer called Ilya Domunsky. And everything that we have done so far is looking absolutely amazing. I think it's going to be an incredibly beautiful work, telling this heartbreaking story, and I cannot recommend it high enough. So we're all excited. The company are so incredibly excited to be delivering another world premiere.
A couple of questions. How long does it take to prepare for a Swan Lake or a Anna Karenina?
Swan Lake, because we know it, so we know the material. So we have spent, you know, a good 5-6 weeks rehearsing it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, not all every hour, every day.
Sure.
But it does take, you know, there's a certain amount, especially for the ladies, for the swans. They get a good 2 hours in the morning. But it does take a while. And then with something like Anna Karenina, we've already spent 12 weeks creating it. Mm-hmm. And then Yuri will be back in January in order to finish the work and really push it to the opening, which is going to be February the 13th.
Now, how do you come about choosing Anna Karenina? Is that something that you, in consensus with your group, with Greg and everyone that's involved with the Joffrey, think that this is a good idea? Or does Yuri come and say, I have this ballet that I'm thinking about, let's have a conversation?
Well, I mean, this is what Yuri would say. 7 years ago, I said to Yuri, Yuri, have you ever thought about doing Anna Karenina?
Really?
And because I know his roots and his Russian background, mm-hmm. and his passion, and I had danced an Anna Karenina years ago in Australian Ballet, and I always loved the story, but I didn't. There weren't many productions out there that I've really enjoyed watching, and I thought, well, who better than Yuri to choreograph a new idea? So he kind of mulled it over, and he was talking about different scores of music, none of which I was really thrilled with. And then Yuri did a very important story for the Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow called A Hero of Our Time, and Ilya Domunsky was the composer, and Yuri and Ilya seem to connect in a really powerful way. So, you know, now we have an original score that follows Yuri's idea for the story, and it packs the most beautiful punch.
You know, I introduce you on our show here, and I always say you are a visionary in the world of dance. You reinforce that every time we talk. 7 years ago you started this, and here we are 7 years later and going to present this because you sowed this seed and now things germinated from there.
Yeah, and it takes a while, and you want to make sure that you have the right team, and you want to make sure that we're able to go out and fundraise for a new production. And I think that, you know, the people in Chicago have really supported the Joffrey. They've seen what we've been doing. The fact that we did a new Nutcracker and we were able to fully fund it before we opened was incredible. With Anna Karenina, we have been able to do a co-collaboration with the Australian Ballet. So interesting that when I danced Anna Karenina, it was in Australia, and now we're going back to Australia with a new production. But the artistic director there as well, David McAllister, also was in the same production that I was. and he has wanted Yuri Posikoff's work in Australia for a long time. So it's a great collaboration, and it's made it, you know, financially viable for us.
It's a great big world, but a very small loop.
Yeah, this is true.
It's very true. Well, you know, it's always a pleasure, my friend, to chat with you, and always stimulating, engaging, and again, another successful year we're going to be looking forward to with the Joffrey, kicking off with certainly one of my favorites, the Swan Lake. Classically trained to the highest standards, the Joffrey Ballet expresses a unique, inclusive perspective on dance, proudly reflecting the diversity of America with its company, audiences, and repertoire, which includes major story ballets, reconstructions of masterpieces, and contemporary works. The company's commitment to accessibility is met through an extensive touring schedule, an innovative and highly effective education program, including the much-lauded Academy of Dance, official school of the Joffrey Ballet, community engagement programs, and collaborations with myriad other visual and performing arts organizations. Founded by visionary teacher Robert Joffrey in 1956, guided by celebrated choreographer Gerald Arpino from 1988 until 2007, the Joffrey Ballet continues to thrive under the Mary B. Galvin Artistic Director Ashley Weider and President and CEO Greg Cameron. On the heels of the highest grossing season in its history, the Joffrey Ballet opens 2018-2019 with the much anticipated return of Christopher Wheeldon's Swan Lake, which became an audience favorite when it premiered in Chicago in 2014. Danced to Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky's classic score and performed live by the Chicago Philharmonic, Swan Lake is presented at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, 50 East Congress Parkway, in 10 performances only, October 17th through the 28th. And on the line with us right now is our dear friend Ashley Weider, the Artistic Director of the Joffrey Ballet. Ashley, always a pleasure, I said before. This is a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to Swan Lake.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it, too, and I know that I will see you there, Kevin.
And for information, 312-386-8905. Continued success, my friend, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Thank you, my pal.
All my best to your listeners.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Ashley Weider, the artistic director, very talented artistic director of the Joffrey Ballet, and what a great season. Swan Lake, and then looking forward to the premiere of Anna Karenina, and of course, you don't want to forget my favorite, and Ashley will be back to chat about around Christmas time. The Nutcracker, again, Tchaikovsky. Again, for information, 312-386-8905. Another essay about October, the expectations of a hauntingly magical month. October is a strange month, no longer summer, and not entirely fall. It represents one of those fragrant in-between times in Chicagoland, when we live in a state of jaunty expectancy. We expect the foliage to gradually reveal its secret colors as nature tenders another majestic funeral. We expect the mornings to begin with a sparkly dew chilling the lawns, but then an Indian summer sun warming the days. And we can't help but expect a splashy burst of autumnal scarves and sweaters, football blankets, and pennants. Really, October is a gigantic impressionist mural, only we're in it. Speaking of Degas and Swan Lake from the Joffrey, perhaps what most of us is expecting in October is magic. Let's be honest, even the oldest and sages of us still harbors some of that little kid magic that once looked forward to mugs of hot chocolate and plates of tappy apples after school. And who can resist those heyday thoughts about what costume will we look best in at the party? And who can inhale the wet perfume of fallen leaves without the anticipation of a white winter? Naturally, Halloween, with its brew of pagan traditions and Christian liturgies, looms as October's premier expectation. Somehow, even parents and coworkers get in touch with its magic spell. Maybe that's because Halloween has this funny way of still giving us once a year permission. Permission to pretend, to hide inside a costume, to let down our very proper hair, and remember, ever so improperly, that magical realm of ghosts, goblins, and gobbledygook. Now it's true that the magic of October shouldn't permit us to forget that serious elections draw close and that serious enemies draw even closer. Yet, is it so wrong to pause for the expectancies of such a special month? to leave the main road of work for the side road of wonder? Besides, we just can't let the kids keep all the pumpkins and possibilities of October to themselves. Expectations of a Hauntingly Magical Month, written by Jack Spadafora from Park Ridge. Maybe a little music from Henry Mancini, great composer. From Charade, the movie with Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, directed by Stanley Donen. And we'll be back on The Kevin Moore Show. See any charade, and we're back on The Kevin Moore Show. A compelling and thrilling story about life and death, love and heartbreak. The Madness of Edgar Allan Poe, a love story, is returning to the stage this fall after playing to capacity audiences in 2015. Called A Smart and Heartfelt Journey by the Chicago Tribune, a masterful take on a master's work by the Daily Herald, and A Perfect Storm of Theater by Chicago Stage Review, Executive Director David Rice's captivating piece will return for its only engagement for the next 5 years and running through November 4th. In 1849, 2 years after the death of his wife, Virginia, Edgar Allan Poe is haunted not just by the specter of his beloved, but also by his many macabre stories. During the course of the madness of Edgar Allan Poe, a love story, Poe and his wife Virginia guide the audience from room to room through historic Maze Lake Hall, taking them from the garrets to the dungeons and deep into the madness of Edgar Allan Poe. David Rice, who received a Jeff Award nomination for new adaptation for this work in 2007, artfully structures the journey into the life and literature of the great American horror writer, focusing with sorrowful clarity on Poe's overwhelming obsession with his wife, Virginia, whom Poe married when he was 13 and he was 27. A perfect evening of madness and macabre, this unique interactive production transports audience members into the world of Edgar Allan Poe with a backdrop of the historic Maze Lake Peabody Mansion. On the line with us right now is David Rice, the co-founder and executive director of First Folio Theater, where he has produced over 50 productions, which have earned 36 Jeff nominations and 5 Jeff Awards. He is also a playwright whose works include Captain Blood, Cymbeline, a musical folktale, and The Castle of Otranto. He is currently working on a number of projects, most recently writing the script and lyrics for Shrewd, a musical adaptation of The Taming of the Shrew, which premiered in the summer of 2018. He has worked at numerous Chicago theaters in the last 35 years, including the Paramount, Marriott's Lincolnshire, Briar Street, and Candlelight. Trivia lovers may be interested to know that David was a 4-time winner on Jeopardy, and he's a proud member of both the Dramatists Guild and Actors Equity Association. Award-winning actor, director, teacher, and mentor, and one of the brightest stars in the world of Chicago theater, now presenting The Madness of Edgar Allan Poe, a love story at First Folio Theater, located on the grounds of the Maze Lake Peabody Estate in Oakbrook through November 4th, Mr. David Rice. David, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you're giving me a chance to be on the radio today.
Well, it's an honor to have you on, and certainly excited about the revival of Edgar Allan Poe's famous story here. And everybody likes Edgar Allan Poe because it scares the daylights out of him, you know?
Exactly. Poe was the master of the macabre, no question about it.
You know, going back to all the stories we used to read or some of the Vincent Price movies we used to see,
Course,
tales of the grotesque and arabesque, and you think of some of them like The Fall of the House of Usher, Murders in the Rue Morgue, The Pit and the Pendulum, The Premature Burial. Those are great, especially around Halloween.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It doesn't get any better than Poe, that's for sure.
And now you've taken a whole different spin on this because Virginia, who was 13 when Poe married her, but still very much in love. People look at that now. This is, of course, in the mid-1800s, and you say, well, that's a little different then. That's true. But that was still a little young. Nonetheless, it was his cousin.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
They were married for, 11 or 12 years?
I believe it was 12 years before she passed away from what they called consumption and what we would call tuberculosis.
Okay. Tell us about the story then.
Well, what we tried to do and what I tried to do when I wrote the script and I originally conceived this whole project with my late wife, Allison, back in 2006.
God bless her.
And thank you. And we wanted something that would allow us to make use of this great mansion where we're located. And I was in love with Poe, and she said, hey, what can you do? You know, what kind of a show can we write? So we kicked ideas around, and she helped me shape it. But what I did not want to do from the beginning, what I didn't want it to do was strictly be a dramatic presentation of Poe's short story. Not that there's anything wrong with that. There's some, you know, some great shows out there that do that.
Sure.
But as someone who truly loved Poe, my hope was that I would be able to find a way to write a show that would help people not only enjoy Poe's work, but come to a better understanding of the man and how this man ended up being driven to write these macabre, bloody tales.
Mm-hmm.
So we wrote a show. We created a show. I wrote a script that combines a number of his short stories and his more famous poems, such as The Raven and Annabelle Lee and The Bells. But weaves within it elements of Poe's life so that you learn about the tragic life that Poe led both before and after he met and married his the love of his life, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when you experience the show, and we don't say watch it because you're moving from room to room. You're inside some of these stories. So you're truly experiencing this. You come to a greater understanding of Poe the man at the same time that you're experiencing the stories themselves.
Well, talk about a participatory aspect of the theater. You certainly reflect that, and everybody's part of this production.
Yeah, absolutely. I do like to stress to people, this isn't a haunted house. Nobody's going to be jumping out at you or screaming at you. but you are inside the room with the madman in the telltale heart, for instance.
And he wrote so many great things. And Poe's a, like you say, a very interesting guy in himself. He was a writer, an editor, a literary critic. Conan Doyle said that we wouldn't have detective stories if it wasn't for C. Auguste Dupin, who, with Poe starting writing his detective stories.
Absolutely. Poe, for all intents and purposes, Poe created the modern detective novel as we know it. He created this character, C. Auguste Dupin, who had a sidekick, who was always at odds with the police, who always outsmarted the police, who solved his mysteries through the use of, well, what Poe called ratiocination, and we'd call it just logic and intuition. But all of the elements that Conan Doyle brought to such complete fruition in the Sherlock Holmes story were all present in Poe's stories about C. Auguste Dupin.
And he was a talented man, and take that a step further, because he influenced science fiction in Jules Verne's work.
Yeah, he was he wrote for a living, and writers did not get paid a lot, so he wrote copious amounts, and he wrote anything that anybody would pay to publish. So he wrote a lot of literary criticism, but he wrote early science fiction, and he wrote sports stories.
Oh, he did? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he wrote some sports news stories, and he wrote science fiction. He would write for any literary magazine or newspaper that would pay him. And yeah, one of his science fiction stories was about a man who took a trip to the moon on a balloon, which later on Jules Verne sort of picked up on and took beyond that. But he wrote about, and again, even some of his macabre stories that deal with imps and demons, are they horror stories or are they science fiction? You know, mm-hmm. hard to classify them in just one way or another.
And this is kind of amazing. It makes it even more amazing, David, is the fact that it happened in the early 1800s that he's doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he was, many people refer to him as America's Shakespeare because he was so prolific and so influential for everything that came after him in the world of the American arts and letters, that's for sure.
When did you first present The Madness of Edgar Allan Poe? When was the first you started the first show?
Fall of 2006.
Well, it's been around that long. So you've been able to tweak it then every time you've presented it.
Yeah, every time we go back and we look at the script, and it depends on who's directing it. My wife directed it. This will be the sixth time total that we've done it. My wife directed it three times, and another member of our Artistic Associates Corps, Michael Goldberg, directed it twice. And this time we've got a woman named Skylar Shrimp who has taken it. And each time the director has come to me and said, you know, I'd like to rethink the way we do this script or this particular section. You know, I think we could make this different this way or clearer that way. And so I have fun because it's always a joy to me to go back and say, okay, let me tear this apart and rebuild this scene or rethink this moment.
It's a work in progress, and you never know what's around the next corner in the Maze Lake Mansion as you're going.
That's right.
Well, what's next up for the First Folio Theater? You've been very successful in presenting Shakespeare out in the beautiful grounds of the Peabody Estate, and every year there's many productions that are so successful. What's up next for David Rice?
We've got a really fun show coming up. It opens the end of January and runs through the end of February. It's by one of our artistic associates, Joe Zettelmeyer, it's a mystery heist comedy script. It's kind of hard to describe it completely, but it's about a group of four Star Wars fans who come up with a plot to to steal a whole hoard of Star Wars collectibles, one of a kind, from the Kenner warehouse in Ohio. And they have this whole plan. And, of course, as with anything else, nothing goes exactly as planned. So yeah.
Now, will you be back on stage as an actor? I know you're very popular as being on the stage acting also.
I have done a lot of acting in the past. No plans for anything in the immediate future, but you know, never say never. We'll see if the right role comes along, and then the director who's doing the show says, "Hey, David, I'd like to see you in this role." I'll give it a shot.
You wear a lot of different hats. Do you have any one preference over the other, or is it good to mix it up a little bit because you maintain that vitality, whether you're acting, whether you're producing, whether you're creating, whether you're writing?
I enjoy acting, but when I'm not doing it, I don't miss it all that much. And, I'll be honest with you, I've done a lot of acting in the past, but the writing and the producing are the two things I love. I love being able to help an incredibly talented team of designers and directors and actors bring these shows to life on stage. But I also love writing, of course. I love being able to create I specialize in adaptation, so I love taking other people's novels or short stories or whatever and finding a way to dramatize them. So.
Well, people have to take advantage of coming to First Folio because this will not be presented for a few years, and if you want to see it, and it's always sold out, so now's the time to do it.
Yeah, we're getting close. We've got some tickets left for the last couple of weeks of the run, but we're just about sold out for this week and almost for next week. And then the last 2 weeks, the tickets are getting pretty scarce. So, yeah, if folks want to, they should go to our website at firstfolio.org and click on the show page. And then there's a link there that will take them to a calendar and let them know exactly what performances still have tickets available.
Well, you don't have to worry about seats because you're going to be walking around most of the time, so you'll be okay.
we do have seating in every room. I mean, they do move from room to room.
Okay.
But there are seats in every room while they're experiencing the show.
First Folio Theater for over 20 years has brought high-quality performances of Shakespeare and other classics to the stage. During that time, the theater has expanded from an annual summer production to a year-round operation with three separate and distinct stages as the historic Maze Lake Peabody Estate. The Shakespeare Book of Lists named First Folio Theater one of the 150 great places to see a Shakespeare play. The Chicago Tribune raved that their Shakespeare Under the Stars summer series offers something Navy Pier can't. Plenty of greenery, gentle breezes, and the chance to stretch out on a blanket with family and friends while being transported to Shakespeare's otherworldly romance. A compelling and thrilling love story about life and death, love and heartbreak, the madness of Edgar Allan Poe, a love story, is returning to the stage this fall after playing to capacity audiences 2015. Called A Smart and Heartfelt Journey by the Chicago Tribune, a masterful take on Master's work by the Daily Herald, and A Perfect Storm of Theater by the Chicago Stage Review, Executive Director David Rice's captivating piece will return for its only engagement for the next 5 years, running through November 4th. And on the line with us right now is David Rice. David, again, a phone number or website if people like some information?
Sure. They can call the box office at 630-986-8067. But the easiest way to see exactly what's available is to go to our website at firstfolio.org. That's firstfolio.org. Then they just click on the show link for Poe, and there'll be a link there that'll take them to the calendar, which will let them know exactly which performances still have tickets available, and they can buy them right online.
I've always enjoyed enjoying your productions at First Folio, and again, continued success. Thanks for taking a little time, and I know this will be another sellout, and if there's anything we can do to get the word out, please don't hesitate to let us know, and we will do that.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much, Kevin. That's always a joy to be on your show.
Thank you, David. David Rice, the artistic director and the co-founder and the executive director of First Folio Theater in Oak Brook. And this is going to be a delightful time in the theater, especially around Halloween. The Madness of Edgar Allan Poe, a Love Story, located at the Maze Lake Peabody Estate in Oak Brook through November 4th. For information, 630 786-8067. Couple final thoughts here as I'm reading here. October is National Pizza Month. Americans eat about 100 acres of pizza a day, 350 slices a second. Pizza is a $30 billion a year industry, and it's the home in the United States of more than 61,000 pizzerias. Italian food is the most popular ethnic food in America, and kids ages 3 to 11 prefer pizza over all other food. Pepperoni is America's favorite topping. Anchovies rank last. And pizza is served mostly as an appetizer in Italy, and it first came to the United States from servicemen after World War II, which made it popular in the United States. The first pizzeria opened in 1830 in Naples. Largest pizza purveyor in the United States is Pizza Hut, and more pizza is consumed during Super Bowl week than any other week of the year. So tonight's a good time to have a pizza. Maybe you should do that. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me and hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. I'd especially like to thank our guest, Ashley Weider, the artistic director of the Joffrey Ballet, now presenting Christopher Wheeldon's reimagining of Tchaikovsky's classic Swan Lake at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, Michigan at Congress, October 17th. Through the 28th, what a great way to introduce young people to the ballet. See Swan Lake, and coming up after that, of course, around Christmas time is The Nutcracker. Always two great presentations by Tchaikovsky. The music is just beautiful. And David Rice, the co-founder and executive director of First Folio Theater, now presenting The Madness of Edgar Allan Poe, a love story. At First Folio Theater, located on the grounds of the Mays Lake Peabody Estate in Oakbrook, through November 4th, for information 630-986-8067. Finally, a famous writer once said, one ought every day at least to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have, at the very least, done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week, and as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. Have a great day.
The way I feel for you, it's now or never. The more I love, the more that I'm afraid. In your eyes I may not see forever. Forever. If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, then any luck, then I suppose the music, the music.